Welcome to the Brown Bagger Program on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Why do the big multinationals get what they want and you get everything you don't want from supposedly elected representatives? Find out in this insider warning from Mel Hertig at the Vancouver Public Library on May 6, 2008. But this isn't just a speech for Canadians. The same rush to offshore capital havens and the same giveaway of national power works even more strongly in the United States, as Mr. Hertig will tell you, and even in Europe. Mel Hertig has been a Canadian bookstore owner and publisher. He is famous as a strong voice for an independent Canada. This speech is from the launch of Mel Hertig's new book, The Truth About Canada, Some Important, Some Astonishing, and Some Truly Appalling Things All Canadians Should Know About Our Country. It was just released by Random House at the end of April 2008. Who gives away their own country and all its resources? Find out in this insider warning. Mel Hertig is introduced by university professor, author, and newspaper writer Michael Byers.
Well, this is a very great honor indeed, not just to introduce a hero of mine, but also someone who in the last 4 years has become a very dear friend. In fact, a dear enough friend that I can actually poke just a little bit of fun at him. Mel is a neighbor of my wife Catherine and myself, and we have him over to our house for dinner from time to time. And we always invite other friends of ours to meet this remarkable individual. And at the end of one evening after Mel had left, a female friend of ours turned to me and said, that man who just left, whoever he was, he certainly has a fairly high opinion of himself. And I smiled and I said, well, you know, I would too if I had created one of Canada's finest bookstores from scratch, one of Canada's most important publishing houses from scratch, if I had led the formation of the Committee for an Independent Canada and persuaded Pierre Trudeau to adopt the Foreign Investment Review Act, if I had been the founding president of the Council of Canadians, if I had written a succession of very important books, if I had even gone so far as to form my own political party and run for prime minister, and more and more and more and more, if I had articulated a proud Canadian nationalism at a time when this country desperately needed it in the most passionate and articulate of terms and touched the hearts of millions of people, yeah, you know, I might just have a fairly high opinion of myself, too. We love you, Mel. A second small anecdote. Mel has been working on his latest book for about 3 years now, and he gets very excited about his work. This is a man who loves what he does and throws it himself into it and into life in general with the greatest of gusto. But I have to say, for 3 years, I began to wonder a little bit, because every time I saw Mel, he would say to me, this is my most important book ever. And being an author myself, I know that you have to, you know, sort of pump yourself up every morning to sit down to write and all this, but, you know, come on, this is the guy who wrote The Betrayal of Canada. This is the guy who wrote Pay the Rent or Feed the Kids, The Vanishing Country, and now, just 3.5 years ago, Rushing to Armageddon, which I reviewed for the Globe and Mail and commented was the most important book published in Canada that year. So how could this be your most important book ever, Mel? I mean, really, how could you match that track record? Well, I have to say to all of you, I spent the last 3 days reading Mel Hertig's latest book. It is not a cheerful read. In fact, at times, it is very depressing. But I can say unequivocally, it is his most important book ever. There is stuff in here that every Canadian needs to learn. This is a litany of a record of a litany of failures, of false impressions, of misleading propaganda that have concealed what our leaders, both political and corporate, in this country have done to this fabulous place over the last 20 years. And Mel Hurdick has cut through all of the crap to explain exactly what has been done. And you know what? He has miraculously, and I hope you get this out of his book when you read it, he has miraculously managed to stay optimistic. His belief, his love of this country comes through in every single word. This is a book that is based upon the assumption, I believe the correct one, that you cannot start to build a great country again until you realize just how far it has fallen. That we need to understand the full scope and detail of the failures in order to make them right. And Mel Hurdick is not trying to mislead anyone. Mel Hurdick is speaking the truth, and it is here in exhaustive, depressing detail, and I urge every single one of you to read it, and I urge you to join me in welcoming a hero of mine, Mel Hurdick, here tonight.
You should never consult too much before you give a speech. I wanted to tell the story of Barack Obama standing on the lawn and looking down and getting a big frown on his face and saying to somebody, "That's the first thing that's going to have to change." And he was pointing to a sign that says White House. And my daughter said, "You can't use that. Some people are going to say you're racist." And I said, "All right, you're right." So then I won't do it. So then I was going to tell them about the email that I got from Toronto. And the email said, "Dear friends and relatives, I just read an article on the dangers of drinking. And the article scared the you-know-what out of me. So that's it. I read the article 3 times and I underlined it in yellow. And that's it. I read it 3 times. So after today, no more reading." And my daughter Leslie, who's chairman of the Literary Festival in Vancouver, said, "Dad, you can't do that because this is an event all about reading. So I can't tell that one either." Today is kind of important for me, not only for the book, but it's kind of an interesting anniversary. I was a bookseller for 17 years. And at one time, I had the largest bookstore in Canada. Then I was a book publisher for 17 years. And we published the largest publishing project in the history of Canada, the Canadian Encyclopedia, which directly involved 3,000 people and another 2,000 paper makers and truck drivers and et cetera, et cetera. And then I sold my publishing company to become an author. And it's 17 years ago this month that I started writing my very first book. So it's 17, 17, and 17. I have no idea what I'm going to do for the next 17 years. And I'd appreciate any suggestions that you may have to offer. Bill Duthy and I were really good friends, and every time I came to Vancouver, well, he helped me a bit with my first bookstore, and I helped him a bit with his first bookstore. And when I used to come to Vancouver, we used to hang out in the bar in the lobby of the Hotel Vancouver, which was right behind his store, as many of you will remember. And we would have an occasional beverage, and occasionally another beverage, and it was very good. But one of the things that we talked about quite often, anyway, Bill and I talked about the problems. We sat on the board of the Canadian Booksellers Association for 10 years together and had a lot of fun, but we talked about problems that we had. And one of the biggest problems that we ever had was that people stole books. And after 17 years as a bookseller, I came to the conclusion that the only people who stole books were ministers, priests, and rabbis, professors and teachers and students, physicians, lawyers, architects, plumbers, carpenters, and chartered accountants, and men, women, and children. Anyway, what I'm going to try to do tonight is tell you a bit about the origin of my book, how and why it came to be, how it's unique in quite a few ways, and how Canadians have so often been intentionally misled by our politicians, our so-called think tanks, our media, and by our big corporations. And then I'll read just a bit from the preface of the book, then I'll give you some of the remarkable and astonishing and amazing, truly appalling things that you're going to find in the book, and I think most of them are things you have almost for sure never, ever seen before. And I'm going to read some of the book's conclusion, and then we'll have a brief question and answer period. Lastly, any of you who may wish me to do so, I'll sign and dedicate copies of the book. I guarantee you that the truth about Canada will shock you and amaze you and certainly change your perspective about what has been happening to our country in recent years in a steady, ongoing, deepening, depressing, and serious deterioration. Now, I first had the idea for this book about 6 years ago, and I signed a contract with McLellan and Stewart to do the book, but I subsequently became so concerned about the dangerous possible ramifications of the American missile defense system relating to possible weaponization of space, relating to the proliferation of nuclear weapons, that I told the publisher that I was going to stop working on that first book and I was going to work on Rushing to Armageddon, which Michael Myers very generously reviewed in the Globe and Mail. And it was about the only book that wasn't a big bestseller for me, although I did sell 6,000 copies, which is often regarded as a pretty good number in this country. And while the book didn't sell as well as my previous book, it did have the intended effect. No other book in Canada and no other book in the United States had anywhere near as detailed an analysis of plans that could lead to this huge escalation in nuclear proliferation. And I know that many members of Parliament read it, encountering therein important information that they never had seen before. And members of the Liberal caucus told me that the Paul Martin government was definitely all set to join the U.S. missile defense scheme until the book came out. But Rushing to Armageddon was so packed with highly regarded scientific experts from the United States, from Britain, from Canada, and other countries that it was quite impossible for the Martin government to ignore it and ignore the detailed, forceful warnings in that book. So the Martin government reluctantly backed away from their all but concluded negotiations with the Bush government and their promises that they had already made to Washington, D.C., much to the annoyance of somebody called George W. Bush. Widely respected arms control expert Senator Douglas Roach said, "Mel's book is shocking and it's factual." Our great Nobel Prize-winning physicist John Polanyi called the book powerful and told people to read it and then tell your friends to go and read it. Well, I average about 5 newspapers a day, and plus many academic and government studies and reports and numerous documents from Statistics Canada and the OECD and the United Nations and many other organizations around the world. What set me to work on the truth about Canada for the first time is my increasing disappointment and then my increasing anger about how Canadians were so often being misled and often deceived. Time after time, for example, I would read something online. First thing in the morning, I go to StatsCan and read what is called the Daily, which, as the name implied, comes out every day, Monday to Friday. And then time after time, when the story then subsequently appeared in the press, I would be dumbfounded at how the information was distorted and manipulated by the time that it reached the press or the television screens across the country. The worst offenders were journalists who never bothered to question the biased nonsense that regularly came from the likes of the Fraser Institute and the C.D. Howe Institute, the Conference Board of Canada, or the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, whenever these conservative continentalist comprador organizations released what was invariably repeated in the media, word for word, as gospel, if not on the front page, then for sure prominently in the first section or on the front page of the business section. One of the many things that most of these lobby organizations that I've just mentioned have in common is that exactly the same big business organization fund them all, using, by the way, your tax dollars to do so. The big banks, the big oil companies, the big coal and forestry companies, the big law firms, the big chartered accountant companies, among others, put up most of the lobbying and the so-called for the so-called think tanks. And unlike the work of, say, the Canadian Council of Social Development or the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, who are invariably referred to as left-wing in the media, these big business think tanks are never called right-wing or never called falling off the right edge of the globe, as they should be. What Tom DeQuino or Jack Mintz or the Chamber of Commerce says is always treated as reliable front-page news or dependable and thoughtful research and commentary. Not only is the public often fed distorted and untrue information, but very often vitally important information from other sources, from the OECD, for example, is either totally ignored or buried deep in the back pages of the newspapers and periodicals. Now, while there are a great many first-class journalists in this country, unfortunately, there are relatively few who have the time or who take the time to question and research the material that they are handed from the agents of big business. Also, it works like this. A Conrad Black or an Asper hire very conservative newspaper publishers. The publisher, of course, hires very conservative editors. The editor, of course, hires very conservative columnists. Most of the editorial staff in a country that has the greatest degree of concentration of the ownership of the media in any major democracy in the world, most of these good people who work for these newspapers, they have mortgages to pay, they have children to send to school or to university, and they are not going to go and offend Conrad Black or the Aspers, because where else are they going to get a job? And it's as unfortunate as that, because of this really terrible media concentration. The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives asked me as a favor if they could publish free of charge one of the chapters in the book. And what chapter do they choose? They chose the chapter on the media. And you're going to read things in the chapter on the media that you're not going to read in the Vancouver Sun or the Globe and Mail or the National Post, etc. So this is one of the big problems that we have in this country, is this concentration of ownership. And it's why we don't get the documented information that you're going to find in my book. Like, it's easy for big business and the right-wingers and the continentalists and the Diane Francises of the world to say, well, you know, we really should join the United States. And most of the money that we have in this country comes from the U.S. Without that money, our standard of living would drop like a stone. Well, all that stuff is just BS. It's just nonsense. It's just not true. The one thing I can say in favor of my book is that all the documentation is in the book. In the footnotes, you can find the exact sources of what I say. And then if you're not sure about it, you can go and look it up yourself online or from the great library that you have here. I'll give you some of the examples I'm talking about shortly. But what you've got in the book is stuff that you can really rely on, as opposed to some of the things you're going to get regularly from the media in this country. Now, there's not time enough to do proper justice to many of the things that you're going to find in the book. But as you hear some of the things I'm going to recite shortly, perhaps you might want to ask yourself some important questions. For example, how come you never heard any of this important information before? Next, how is it that our politicians ever allowed these terrible things that I'm going to describe to happen to our country? And since poll after poll after poll shows that the great overwhelming majority of Canadians have different priorities and different perspectives than the CEOs of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives and the wealthy guys in this country, how is it that the big CEOs get their way every time in a Liberal government or in a Conservative government? The overwhelming majority of Canadians may want a different form of taxation. The CEOs want something else, and they get their way. So I want to read to you very briefly the dedication to the book. The Truth About Canada is dedicated to the wonderful people at UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. Ultimately, my book is about social justice. It's about the quality of life and about democracy. The following quote is from UNICEF's 2007 Innocenti report, and here's what they said. The true measure of a nation's standing is how well it attends to its children, their health and their safety, their material security, their education and their socialization, and their sense of being loved, valued, and included in the families and societies into which they are born. And then when you hear some of the following, you'll see how we have failed in so many of the things I've just described. Okay, from the preface of the book, this book is about how Canada has changed, and changed very much for the worse, under the governments of Brian Mulroney, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. It is also about how, as a result of these profound changes that have occurred, we are no longer the country that we think we are, and no longer the people that we think we are. In chapter after chapter, you will discover just how different we have become from our longtime self-images and from what has been our international image. You'll see how far Canada has departed from the principles and the ideas that help Canada become one of the most admired countries in the world, and the country that the overwhelming majority of Canadians, overwhelming, have cherished for so long. An important feature of the Truth About Canada is the fascinating international comparisons it contains that show how we stack up against other countries around the world, but principally against the other 29 OEC developed countries. It's no exaggeration to say that you'll find a great many of these comparisons disappointing, shocking, and even appalling. Another main theme in the pages that follow is the dismal failure of our big business corporate leaders to use their gigantic, all-time record, record-breaking profits, and their substantially reduced corporate taxes, which are now, by the way, well below American corporate tax rates and well in the lower quarter of the other 29 OECD countries. The failure of these extremely profitable and relatively low, contrary to the garbage you get to the contrary in our media and the National Post and the Financial Post, etc., these relatively low tax countries. By the way, next time you hear somebody say, oh, taxes in Canada are so high, Diane Francis, for example, you tell them that we're now, in 30 countries, we're now 21st in terms of the total tax load. That is total taxes, that is the GST, that is corporate taxes, that is property taxes, that is everything that you can think of. These big businesses have totally failed to do research and development. So if you look to take their money and invest it in R&D, so if you look at the figures that you'll find in this book on R&D, we're way at the bottom. We're 29th in one list, we're 40th in another list. Now, in an increasingly competitive world, how the heck do you compete with all these countries like China and India coming up and all the rest of them and the Scandinavian countries if you don't do R&D? The other thing they have totally failed to do is they don't invest now in new machinery and equipment. Well, how do you, at the same time, they complain about productivity. They complain about productivity. They don't give their workers new machinery and equipment to work with, even though the dollar has risen like this, making it much easier to import new machinery and equipment. What have they been doing instead? Incredibly, as their taxes have fallen in Canada, the graph of the money that they send out of Canada is on a 45-degree angle. increasingly, every year, a record amount of good old Canadian money, instead of being invested in industry in this country, gets shipped out of the country. And where is it shipped to? Can you guess? Tax havens. It's shipped to tax havens, and out it goes from the country. They can then deduct interest rates if they borrow some money from their profits in Canada. And guess who it is? Makes up the missing revenue for Canadians. And, of course, you're looking at them to your left and your right and in front of you, etc. A further theme is the unparalleled sellout of our country in a manner that no other developed country would ever dream of allowing. While this has been taking place at a greatly accelerated rate, the purposeful dissemination in the print media of false information downplaying the rapidly growing foreign ownership and control of Canada goes a long way to explaining our myopic politicians and why they have failed to take action on this and other related problems, as we quickly are robbing ourselves of our ability to plan and manage our own future. There is no other country in the world that would allow the degree of foreign ownership and control that we have in this country. There's no other country in the world that would allow the petroleum industry to be majority foreign owned, the rubber industry, the chemical industry, and the computer industry, et cetera, et cetera. People have said, well, isn't there a lot of foreign investment and Canadian investment in the United States? You should measure it on the basis of GDP in the United States, the amount of, the number of workers working for foreign-controlled companies is roughly about 4%. In Canada, it's closer to 35%, and it's growing substantially every single year. So my chapter on the Free Trade Agreement is subtitled The Greatest Con Job in Canadian History. When you read it, I hope you will ask yourselves, why have you never read any of this information before in our newspapers or our magazines? Why have you never seen anything remotely like this on television? God knows you've been inundated regularly with an abundance of continentalist propaganda to the contrary. The chapter in the media should help explain why this important information has never been available to you before. When you read the economic chapters in this book on foreign ownership, on trade, on investment, on productivity, on competitiveness and taxation, I hope you will be aware of the fact that exactly the same people who have intentionally left us in these weakened positions have for some time now been having secret meetings, and I'll talk about it in the conclusion, planning for more of the same, planning for more integration of Canada with the United States, planning to surrender more ownership and control of our businesses, planning to guarantee Americans more access to our natural resources, and they're having high-level meetings to integrate Canada with the United States right now. And I'll speak about those shortly. Big business in the form of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, the very same people who put us in this lousy position with two so-called trade agreements, which, by the way, weren't really about trade, as you will see in those chapter on the FTA and on NAFTA. I mean, I have to tell you something. It boggles my mind that any Canadians who care about our country could have ever signed the NAFTA agreement. And to show you how we've become a colonial institution, the panic in Ottawa and in the media about, oh my God, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton want to cancel the NAFTA, it would be the best possible thing that could ever happen to Canada.
You are listening to Mel Hertig, author, publisher, and a lasting voice for Canadian sovereignty. This speech is from the book launch May 6, 2008 in Vancouver, Canada of The Awful Truth About Canada, Some Important, Some Astonishing, and Some Truly Appalling Things All Canadians Should Know About Our Country. The speech demolishes corporate media, the betrayal of politicians, and the secret cabal to merge Canada with the United States. And this is CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver.
You know, during the NAFTA negotiations, the Americans said, well, we've got to have more guaranteed control over the natural resources. And Mexico said, Are you kidding? There's not a chance that we would allow you to do what you're asking. The Americans said, we want a guaranteed pro rata share of the amount of oil that you produce and the amount of natural gas. If you're producing, if you're selling us 65% of all your natural gas this year, I don't care if you're running short in Canada. I don't care if it's a cold country. You're going to have to continue selling us 65% in the future, whether you like it or not. And guess what? If Russia or somebody else wants to pay, or China wants to pay us three times as much as you pay us for oil or for natural gas or whatever, you have to charge Americans with exactly the same amount of money that you charge Canadians. Now, I can't think of any other country that would agree to something as incredibly stupid as that. And then wait till you get to the chapter on water. A government, as long as you can remember, will tell you, hey, you don't have to worry about water. Water's not in the trade agreement. When you read the chapter on water, you're going to see two of the best experts in the country explain why, in fact, there's a real danger for us losing control of our water. And on the prairies today, the prairie rivers are drying up. They're drying up because of what's happening to our glaciers, thanks to global warming. And they're drying up because of the incredible amount of water that's being used in the awful tar sands. And, as sure as you are in this room tonight, I can tell you without the slightest hesitation that not too long from now, the Americans are going to use the clauses in NAFTA that I mention in some detail in that chapter to say, I'm sorry, you guys, you've got to start sharing your water with us, whether you like it or not. And that action will be started by American corporations, and it will be funded by the American government. And everybody in this room knows what the water situation is now in the United States and what big trouble they are in. Well, the truth about Canada is a result of many long days and months and years of research. It will certainly be regarded as my most controversial book. And I told Peter Newman if my body is found on Bay Street, he will know what has happened. And the book will bring immediate cries of protest from the usual Neanderthals at the Fraser Institute and the C.D. Howe Institute and the Canadian Council of Chief Executives and the increasingly, remarkably Continentalist Conference Board of Canada, and, of course, the house organ of all of them, the National Post. One editor asked me if I was not apprehensive about the strong criticism that such a tough book would inevitably bring. Well, the answer is simple. You cannot ever expect to accomplish anything important without bringing criticism from the entrenched forces that this book describes and blames for what has gone wrong to our country. Whether it's the pathetically low number of doctors, our incredibly high levels of child poverty and adult poverty in this country. You remember 1989, there was an all-party resolution in the House of Commons that everybody supported. We were going to abolish child poverty by the year 2000. Everybody supported it. It was a great goal. Ladies and gentlemen, in 2008, the level of child poverty in this country is exactly the same as it was back in 1989. And our level of child poverty and our level of adult poverty, as you will discover in this book, is way higher than most developed countries in the world. Is that something that makes you proud as a Canadian, to have the kind of poverty that we have in this country compared to Sweden and Denmark and France and Germany and Finland and et cetera, et cetera? We're 22nd in the world of the 30 OECD countries in the amount of poverty that we have in this country. Hey, but it's okay. Remember, got a lot of poverty? Well, obviously, what we're going to do is we're going to have great social programs, right, as a result. We're 21st in the amount of money we spend as a percentage of GDP in terms of social programs. Under Mulroney and under Chrétien and under Martin and under this guy, Harper, the graph of our spending on social programs has gone downhill at a 45-degree angle. Well, if that's the case, if we've got such high poverty, and if we don't spend very much on social programs, then obviously we've got to have a pretty good system of welfare so that people don't suffer too much. Are you kidding? We're 22nd in the world, in the developed nations, in terms of the amount of money that we spend on welfare. People on welfare in Canada today are receiving less than they did on any comparative basis in real terms than they received back in 1980. The huge increases in the number of people in poverty, but GDP in this country, since we made that resolution in the House of Commons back in 1989, GDP has increased by over $900 billion and more than doubled. So you have to say to yourself, well, what happened to the money? Where did the money go? I mean, if we're not spending it on social programs, if we're not spending it on research and development, if we're not spending it on welfare, where did it go? Well, a huge amount of it went out of the country to tax havens. That went out of the country. A lot of these companies borrow money from Canadian banks, and then they take the money and the interest charges, and they deduct it from their profits, and then they send their money to tax havens, and where they don't pay any tax at all. And hold your hand up if you think any of you pay for that tax that's missing. So if you look at some of the things that you'll find in this book on poverty, wages, distribution of income and wealth, I'm sure most of you probably saw the articles recently about wages in Canada, with no important changes in wages for the working people of this country in the period 1980 to 2005. That's a quarter of a century. And most of the middle class had no gains whatsoever in the amount of... here's the good news. The National Post makes fun of those Statistics Canada statistics. But here's the good news. I just figured this out this morning. Over a period of 25 years, family income, with huge increases in the number of women that have gone to work, because often they have to do that, the amount of changes in family income in this country over 25 years, whereas many CEOs have increased their incomes by $3 to $5 million a year, for the vast middle class in this country, the amount of increase has worked out to increases in wages of 0.4% a year. And that gives you a pretty good indication of what's gone wrong with this country. I'm going to stop talking fairly soon, but I just want to give you some of the numbers in the book. Social spending, we're 25th out of 30 countries. Low-paid jobs, why are there so many poor children in this country when our unemployment rate is so low? Pretty simple. Canada has one of the highest low-paid ratio of low-paid jobs that there is among the developed world. UI, which incredibly stupidly is called employment insurance now, we're 22nd of 30 countries in the world in terms of how much people get paid to reimburse them for lost income. All right, let's see what else. Here's a dandy for you. Just think about this for a minute. I'm going to ask you to guess. The top 6% of Canadians own what percent of the wealth in this country? The top 6% of Canadians own what percent of... Well, you read the book. That's not fair. Can you imagine the top 6% own 97% of the wealth in this country? Where do we stand in Canada? You know, this great, egalitarian, wonderful country that we've developed. We're 40th in terms of the distribution of income. That is, you compare the bottom 10% to the top 10% in all these countries, or the bottom 20% to the top 20%. We're 40th in the distribution of income. I'll give you one more. Now, this one here, just before the manuscript went to the publisher, I came across this. I couldn't believe it. I read it, and I read it two times, and then I read it three times, and I got on the phone with some people, and they said, what? That's not true. And I checked it again. I checked it again with the source, which was the United Nations. In an increasingly competitive world, Canada's public expenditure on education, as a percentage of all government spending, is, we are now 91st. Now, those of you who have children, or those of you who have kids going to university, etc. You should keep that in mind, because it's a pretty good idea of one of the most important things that has happened to this country. All right, where are we in peacekeeping? You know, what Lester Pearson did in peacekeeping? He established that 0.7% percentage of money of GDP that we should be giving to peacekeeping. We were once one of the great peacekeeping nations in the world. Canadians still think we're great peacekeepers, and we are now 36th in the world in peacekeeping. There isn't a single Canadian officer in the United Nations peacekeeping headquarters in New York. Not one. One last statistics where I get on to, where I go on to another topic. I'm going to ask you. Brian Mulroney abolished the Foreign Investment Review Agency. And he said it was restricting money coming into this country, blah, 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 which wasn't true, by the way. He abolished the Foreign Investment Review Agency and established the Investment Canada. And since then, $847 billion worth of investment has been measured by Investment Canada. Okay, you know, if you read all from these organizations that I mentioned earlier, all these right-wing organizations, take a guess, and not if you read the book, take a guess as to what percentage of that $847 billion was for takeovers of companies in Canada, and what percentage was for new business investment in this country. Who wants to guess? All right, I can't get you. 97.6% of that $847 billion was for takeovers of Canadian companies, and a puny 2.4% was for new business investment. All right, let's turn to another topic here. Quite often when I'm speaking across the country, people will ask me, Mel, what do you want to do? If you were head of this country, prime minister or whatever, if you wanted to make an important change, what would you do? And I said, I know exactly what the very first thing I would do. And I'm going to read just briefly from the chapter saying, reforming our dysfunctional electoral system. We had an electoral system in this country that makes no sense whatsoever. Whenever I go across Canada during the question and answer session, one of my speeches, someone in the audience invariably asks me what my most important priority would be to make Canada a better country. My answer has been the same for most of the last 20 years. We desperately need election reform. Remarkably, almost 40% of those who didn't vote in recent elections said that the election didn't really matter because their vote didn't really matter, because it didn't help elect anybody. We'll give you the Green Party, 650,000 votes the last election, federal election, I think, and they elected no members of parliament. And the Bloc, Quebecois, gets the same number of votes, they elect 21 members of parliament. Stelmach gets a sweeping victory in Alberta, and he gets it with 22% of the eligible voters. Jean Chrétien gets three majority governments, and never once is he over 40% of the vote. And once it's 39. All right, here's a question. What percent of Canadians in the 2000 election made a donation to any political party? Who wants to tell me? What percent made a donation to any political party? 5. 3. 0.75%. Less than 1% of Canadians made a donation to any political party. So what does that tell you about political participation? How are you going to change your country unless 80% of Canadians have never belonged to any political party? Women in Parliament, 36th. Among developed countries. And there's a whole long list of other statistics. The page after page in this book that shows you that the In the 2006 federal election, the New Democrats received a million more votes than the Bloc, but the Bloc received 51 more seats than the NDP did. And again, example after example after example, where our system simply does not work properly. What we need to have in Canada is what 80 other countries in the world have. Exactly. A mixed member proportional representation system. And when you have that, you suddenly see a huge rise in the percentage of people who go out and vote and who become active in political parties to make it into a real democracy. My first priority is a mixed member proportional representation system. You guys are going to be voting, I guess, in a year for the STV system, which is a form of reform. It's not as good as the one I would prefer, but I urge you to go out and vote in favor of it anyway. It's infinitely better than the kind of system that you presently have. The conclusion, from the conclusion, you'll be pleased to hear. In February 2003, the Vice President of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, pretty important guy, in Canadian Senate hearing said that de facto integration of Canada with the United States was, quote, already here, whether many Canadians realize it or want to accept it, and that we don't need to have duplicate systems of approval anyway. Have you got that? No need for duplicate systems of approval. I suppose then that there's no need for the House of Commons. There's no need for provincial legislatures. Why don't we just rubber stamp American policies, standards, and values? Back in 2002, the Continentalist Financial Post columnist Diane Francis said, quote, Canada is already more integrated with the United States economically than any two countries in Europe are already. And the noted Canadian economist from British Columbia, Richard Harris, and the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, D.C., said the same thing. David O'Brien, the chairman of the board of the Royal Bank of Canada, which has been one of the worst institutions in Canada, pushing integration between Canada and the United States, and I hope some of you who bank at the Royal Bank of Canada will keep that in mind. And he, O'Brien, said, we're going to increasingly lose our sovereignty, but it's necessarily so. Patrick Daniels, the president of Enbridge, ridiculously complained that Canada pushes its sovereignty too far. In June of 2006, the North American Competitive Council, consisting of business leaders from each of the NAFTA countries, was formed to, quote, advise governments, end of quote. And all of the members of this organization are, in fact, members of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, the lobby group which serves as a Canadian secretariat, which my friend Silver Donald Cameron calls the Canadian Council of Chief Collaborators. In the preface to this book, I alluded to top secret meetings behind closed doors that have already been held and more of them for the future. Top secret. In fact, these guys hired a public relations company to counsel every member who attended these meetings about how to avoid the press and don't let anybody know what was going on. Now, these meetings are designed, what for? To further integrate Canada into the United States, to have us adopt more American standards of values, to give the Americans even more guaranteed access to our resources and unimpeded ability to buy up the ownership and the control of even more of our country. Now, I don't know about you, but my ambition is not to have my grandchildren grow up to be as tenants in their own country. And Peter Newman says, as serfs in our own country. That's not a normal country. There's no other country that you can think of that would allow that sort of thing. Now, perhaps you guys don't know about the 3 days of highly secret meetings that took place at the Banff Springs Hotel in mid-September 2006. Meetings between top-level American, Canadian, and Mexican government officials and many senior corporate heads. In fact, you probably don't know. But then again, why should you know? Despite the fact that the long list of high-level attendees was leaked to me, and I sent it out to the media, along with the agenda, There wasn't a word about the meetings in our two national newspapers, the Globe and Mail or the National Post. There was nothing on CBC television. There was nothing on CTV. There was nothing on Global. And I sent out great details about the hugely important people, the former U.S. Secretary of State, George Shultz, and Donald Rumsfeld, right-hand man, and the former Secretary of the Treasury of Mexico were at these meetings. And there's a whole long list on page 401 of absolutely incredibly important Canadian cabinet ministers, federal cabinet ministers, heads of Lockheed Martin, and et cetera, from the United States, who attended these meetings. And when I leaked the list to the press, and I sent it out to my own email list, and by the way, at the back of the book you'll find my email address, and if any of you want to be on my email list, you're welcome to do so. Print very neatly so I can read it, your email address, and I'll add you. I send out four or five things a month. And so I sent this stuff out, and people got very concerned about it, and they started making phone calls around the country to the people who were on that list. Nobody returned the calls. Nobody. And Peter Newman, it's in here somewhere if I can find it. Peter Newman said, I can't find it. He said, I asked questions of people who I know and know very well and people who are friends of mine, and none of them answered my questions. And Peter Newman said in this book, he says, if it isn't a conspiracy, they're sure behaving like it is a conspiracy. And those meetings are still going on. There's about 30 cross-border committees between Canada and the United States that are definitely tied to the integration of our country even further with the United States than it has been in the past. So, any of you read anything in the Vancouver Sun about this? Anything? Have you read anything in the Globe and Mail about it? In the National Post? Okay, that's good. 6 months after the meeting, Ottawa Citizen reporter Kelly Patterson revealed that, with the Freedom of Information thing, that organizers of the controversial summit of top Canadian, U.S., and Mexican politicians, military brass, and business executives hired a consulting firm to keep the proceedings secret, access to information documents show. Quote, a media management plan for the event in Banff last fall imposed a gag order on all participants who were directed to avoid direct media engagement wherever feasible. What has that got to do with democracy? What has that got to do with the way government is supposed to work? What has it got to do with the way the decision-making process about the future of our country is? Incredibly, in the United States, 15 U.S. states have expressed concern that the big business-sponsored Security and Prosperity Partnership is a process that, wait for it, is a threat to state rights and to sovereignty in the United States. Now, have you heard any one single person in the Harper government say anything about that? Not exactly. Okay, all this covert under-the-table planning is happening in Canada, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of Canadians, year after year, in poll after poll, show that they don't want to integrate further with the United States, show that they believe Canada has been too good a country for us to surrender to our greedy and selfish big business leaders whose values are so very different from those of most Canadians and who are still very proud of our country, our culture and our history, our values, our civility, our tolerance, and they are not the slightest bit interested in further harmonization and integration with the United States. Alas, the compradors, the neocons, and the continentalists are powerful, they're well-organized, they're well-financed, and we now know that the initial SPP agenda included some 300 items. In the words of a spokesman for the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, quote, many of these represent very small steps, but on the other hand, even 300 small steps, if we take them all, add to a pretty giant leap for North America. In 2007, a small group of Canadians, including authors, academics, musicians, and former politicians, joined forces to further oppose integration with the United States, and they issued a statement. Excuse me. Canada faces a stark choice. We can be gradually assimilated and lose our identity as a nation, or we can retain our independence and renew our own unique vision of what we wish for Canada's future. A vision of strong communities, tolerance, equality, environmental stewardship, and a peaceful and a constructive role in the world. We believe that in spite of recent developments, Canadians believe passionately in the traditional values that guided this country into its post-war nation building. Security and prosperity partnership will give us neither security nor prosperity, nor is it a genuine partnership. We stand against this scheme and urge other Canadians to join us. Recently, the Globe and Mail columnist Neil Reynolds, a right-wing columnist, wrote this year in the Globe, "For those folks who still resist the economic integration of North America, and there are a very few, strident few left," that's you guys, I guess, "it's getting awfully late for a comeback." Well, that's true. If we want to regain the control of our country, we've got to start getting more directly involved in politics. I love the Suzuki Foundation. I love the Sierra Club. I love the Council of Canadians, etc. But if you want to help regain control of your country, you've got to become directly involved in politics. And you have to do it with either donations or active involvement or going door to door or whatever, so that we beat these guys who are trying to sell out our country. If you don't do that, you're leaving it up to them to grab control of the agenda for the future of our country. So, in conclusion, we've got an interesting situation coming up politically. We've got the certainty of a federal election happening relatively soon. We've got a situation where Harper, the minute he gets the first good poll that shows that he's got a 10-point lead over the Liberals, he will force a situation, whether it's this ridiculous bill on not funding films that they don't like, if you can imagine. Can you imagine that as an election issue? You can see a bunch of the Tories lined up watching films. I don't like that one, because there was half of a breast showing, and we got to do something about that. Anyway, he wants an election as soon as possible. Mr. Dion, who everybody I know says is an extremely nice man, whatever the opposite of the word charisma is, Dion has it. And that's unfortunate. So we've got a very volatile situation, a strong indication that there'll probably be another minority government. And God forbid if there ever should be a Harper majority government, you won't recognize how he is going to change this country. The first thing he's going to do is accelerate the rate of decentralization. He's going to give away the powers of the national government. He's, you know, after all, Quebec is a nation, and we're going to prove that being a nation means you get all these extra powers. Do you think the people of British Columbia will for a moment stand for the same powers not being given to British Columbia? Do you think the people of Alberta will for a moment not agree to the same powers? Welcome to the new northern Balkan states of North America, because that's Stephen Harper's agenda, giving away the power of the central government and giving it to today, unknown to most people, the provinces and local governments in Canada spent a far greater total of all the government spending in Canada than the federal government spends. And he's headed for doing more of the same. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for coming out tonight. It means a great deal to me. Thank you.
That was Mel Hertig, author, publisher, and a lasting voice for Canadian sovereignty. The speech was from the book launch May 6, 2008 in Vancouver, Canada, of The Truth About Canada, Some Important, Some Astonishing, and Some Truly Appalling Things All Canadians Should Know About Our Country. The evening was presented by the Necessary Voices Society. Find them at necessaryvoices.org. Mel Hertig was recorded by Alex Smith for CFRO, the Tuesday Brown Bagger Program in Vancouver.